Save big on all your back-to-school needs, all in the Kroger app. Get three-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean ground beef for $3.99 a pound with your card. Then get Oreo cookies, Chips Ahoy, or Kool-Aid jammers for $1.99 each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I mean, honestly, my feeling is if you believe that one of these large language models can generate a story better than you, then perhaps you don't have a business in writing anyway. How are we humans so certain that we have the only way to access truth, beauty, and narratives that are worth telling? Let me tackle this by seeming to go in a different direction, but I promise it's all related. So I'm going to go in a different
just
direction.
Just like an author.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another Tudor Ramble episode. I'm one of your hosts, Austin.
And I'm your other host, Richard.
And Richard and I have the distinct privilege of having the one and only Ken Liu on this podcast, author of The Grace of Kings, Paper Menagerie short story. We even have them on the shelves displayed just for you, Ken. Welcome aboard to the Rambler podcast.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
We were telling Ken just before, you know, Rich and I read The Paper Menagerie yesterday in prep of this, and he hasn't heard this from the Hugo or the World Fantasy Awards or any of that. But Rich, yeah.
Insignificant people. Yeah.
Rich, do you give it the Rambler approved score? You say it's good?
Oh, yes, it's Richard Rambler approved. Oh God, I was thrown for a loop on it, and one this that story on just on a basic level confirmed to me of my frustration with a lot of long fantasy of going. Fantasy doesn't need to be this long.
Be careful. Ken writes long fantasy, you know. Don't anger him.
There's good stuff to it, but when people tell me like, oh yeah, you need all that page time to really fall in love with the characters. Bollocks. You can fall in love with characters in like five pages. One page, in all honesty. So it's a great story about really human touching subject of motherhood and culture and regret, history. It's a wonderful story.
It's like 20 pages, so easy to read. And yeah. Ken, so we're going to be talking aliens, AI, humanity, everything. Ken, welcome to the podcast.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Well, that was a great opening. I mean, maybe the whole podcast can just go that way. I'll just sit here and listen.
So, Ken, Rich had a good starting off point with talking about your story. And did you want to begin us with that and then transition into this whole AI talk? We can hammer that.
Sure. I did want to just briefly talk about and just ask you the question, and for people listening who've read the story, what inspired that story? Did it come from a place like a personal experience, or did it come from maybe something, a story you've heard from a friend? What inspired that story?
So I think I've told the story before, but briefly, the way it came to be was there was a call for submissions for stories about wizards, and I wanted to come up with a story that was very original. And this is something that I teach my writing students a lot, which is you can actually teach yourself to be more original. And the secret really is to just know to say no. Because the way your brain works is you tend to, it's associational, right? So whenever an idea is raised, you tend to sort of follow the most well-worn connections to other ideas, which means that when you're given a prompt, the very first ideas that come to mind are likely to be cliches because they have the strongest connections, right? They've been repeated so much. So what you want to do is just to keep on saying no to the first ideas until you push past the first 10, 20 ideas. And then you start to form new associations to make connections where there weren't any connections before. And that's how you get the original ideas. So, you know, it actually is, I'm trying to give my students a very practical methodology for how to push themselves to come up with more original ideas. So that was sort of the idea here. I try to push past all the typical ideas about what a wizard is. And I ended up with this idea of somebody whose magic is in bringing origami alive. And the idea actually is sort of a very, it's very typical of my methodology. A lot of my fantasy involves trying to make what is literal something that is otherwise merely metaphorical. So we often speak about the way love makes something makes the world seem more alive or makes things seem more vivid. So here is, you know, what is otherwise merely metaphorical made literal. She actually can, from love, breathe life into these creatures and animate them. Right. So that's the core idea. Then the third idea is I have been reading and doing some research into the history of women who who basically, for lack of a better term, are commonly referred to as mail order brides. These are women from the global south, typically, who in order to improve their own lot and their own opportunities, go and seek marriages with the developed world. And typically women, I mean, they're an important part of our history, an important part of the global reality that we live under. I mean, they're a reflection of the unequal distribution of power and wealth and the limitations that different societies place on the way individuals can advance. So they are an important topic, but they're also typically viewed negatively in popular culture. And they're often sort of the, you know, target of jokes, which I found deeply unsettling. And reading the narratives written by these women about their own lives was very instructive. You know, these are very moving stories. These women are incredibly courageous to do what they did, to go through this very, very, traumatic experience. I mean, I can't even imagine sort of leaving behind everything you know and sort of putting your hope into the idea that you're going to find love and be able to create a new life for yourself. I mean, obviously, you know, the reality is incredibly complicated, and these women's stories are very moving precisely because they are complicated, nuanced, and very human. So I wanted to write a story inspired by these narratives that would, in some ways, get at this idea of the humanity and the deep complexity that all of us share. Yeah, that's pretty much the three pieces that made up the story. I mean, the coda of that is the story was not accepted by the anthology. It probably pushed too far in the idea of what a wizard can be. But I ended up, you know, selling it to the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. And it actually received a very good market as a result and got some great buzz. So that's kind of the story behind the story.
I feel like this is not to take away, but I just would find it funny to hear. Do you happen to remember what your first idea was when you got this prompt? The one that you said no to.
Oh, absolutely. The very first idea was a guy in a pointy hat and long white beard and, you know, holding a crystal, you know, sort of like the your crystal wizard. That's wow. That was the first idea, obviously.
And I think that's I love that starting off point, because Ken, do you think that from this whole idea set of starting cliche and then getting to something that is more unique or something new, adding something, do you think that AI one day will be able to replicate that? Do you think that, how far along do you think it is currently, and how will that combat with authors like yourself?
So the topic of AI is obviously very huge. And I want to sort of say that there are certain aspects about AI that I'm interested in, certain aspects that I'm not terribly interested in. So let me explain to you which pieces I'm not really interested in first, so that it will make
That'd
sense.
That'd be good. Yeah, we'll stay off that.
Yeah. So there's a lot of talk about AI, right? One of the more popular things that people sort of speculate about happens to be the kind of thing that I don't care about at all, which is the idea of AI writing stories or generating screenplays or what have you. This is the thing that we're all talking about. You know, AI is going to replace screenwriters, AI is going to replace novelists. I don't really, it's not interesting to me, actually. And the reason for that is twofold. One is perhaps I'm a little bit arrogant. And the other is perhaps I'm a little bit too humble. So I'll explain to you why. The arrogant part is this. I don't really see how AI is currently constituted or even iterated upon, but as currently constituted largely architecturally. I don't really see that as ever conceivably being able to write novels that can compete with me. I just don't find that particularly plausible.
I wish I had that kind of confidence. Oh,
that's the arrogance topic, right? So I don't really see how AI can ever write the sort of thing that I do, because current AI is largely geared towards regurgitating cliches, right? It's a plausibility machine. What they do is they try to generate output that is plausible and similar to the input they were trained on. So that necessitates a kind of prioritization on believability and sort of imitating what is already there. But my personal opinion is the reason why we get into art and the reason why artists are interesting is because they try to say something that actually is not a cliche, right? So every writer, I think, starts out largely like these generative models. They try to acquire and read a lot of good stuff in order to train themselves in what is good prose, what is a good story, what is a good form. But they have to sort of move beyond that. In order to actually become a real artist, they all have to invent their own language, because the reason people are interested in reading an artist is because a new novelist or whatever it is, because the artist has a new vision about the universe that has not been realized before. And in order to say something that is genuinely new, the artist has to invent a new language. So that's why, any writer worth reading ultimately ends up having to invent her own language. So if you read Emily Dickinson, she writes like no one else in her era. You read Herman Melville, he writes like no one else in his era. Every writer who is worth reading has a unique language, and by which I mean not just the way they use words, but their grammar, their imagery, their particular use of tropes, the way they lean into certain things and the way they invent and push the genre that they choose to write in new directions. They have to invent a new language, and readers have to learn that new language in order to appreciate what they do. So, I like to say that, there's no one else who can write a Ken Liu story or a Ken Liu novel. So I'm not terribly, I've study these AI efforts very deeply. But as far as I can tell, if they're ultimately interested in imitating, and all that the machines do is just imitate, then they'll never be able to outcompete me. I'm not worried about it, really. I mean, honestly, my feeling is if you believe that one of these large language models can generate a story better than you, then perhaps you don't have a business in writing anyway. Because if the machines can outcompete you, then what are you doing? It's not, that's the arrogant part. Now, come to the humble part. The humble part is a flip side of that, which is, how are we humans so certain that we have the only way to access truth, beauty, and narratives that are worth telling, right? So today's LLMs are merely plausibility imitation machines. But if we don't stick to that architecture, if we actually ultimately pursue a level of architecture beyond that, and we get to the point where AI actually has not merely imitation and not merely, symbolic manipulation, but actually has a real experience of the universe. So let's say that we have embodied AI of some sort, that these AI are able to basically punch the universe and, feel the universe punch back. And they actually are engaged in the universe, and they actually acquire consciousness, whatever that means. I'm not going to define it, but whatever that means. If we get to the point where the AI actually has that, and then the AI writes a story, then of course I'm interested in reading that story, but it's not going to be like my story. This will be a separate consciousness, and therefore it will have to invent its own language to tell the stories that no humans can tell. I would love to read a toaster writing about what it's like to be a toaster. I would love to read a novel written by an aircraft carrier about what it means to have war and peace. I would love to read a satellite's view of what it means to be outside of this blue marble. These are incredibly interesting things. I would love to read about those perspectives and experiences. But again, I'm not really scared because they will be writing different things than me. They would not be me, and therefore they will write different stories. And, you know, we would just be two authors trying to celebrate our love for storytelling together. I mean, I'm hoping that the AI will actually be able to tell stories that I can understand. Maybe the AI will invent such a new language that it will be incredibly hard for me to learn, but I'm hoping that it will be difficult in the way Cormac McCarthy is difficult, meaning you spend some time and learn the language and you can actually get it, as opposed to, I don't know, you know, whale song difficult, which is so alien that it's very hard for us to even get it. But I'm hoping that AI will tell a story that's not so alien that we can't even comprehend it. I would like to think that's the case. So for both of those reasons, I'm not particularly concerned about AI replacing writers. It doesn't bother me as a thing. I know lots of other writers are, but I can't get excited about it. It's not interesting to me. But I can tell you what other things I am interested in, though. I'm particularly interested in the idea that AI can be a tool for humans to create better art. So the analogy here would be thinking about AI as the camera or the telescope or the microscope or camera obscura, right? Something that replaces or amplifies human sensorium and makes something that is otherwise very tedious for humans to do not so tedious, and then thereby enlarging the capacity and reach of human imagination into new arenas that could not be reached previously. In the same way that, you know, when the camera was first invented, it was perceived as a threat to a lot of artists. But obviously, you know, if you study the history of 19th century art, the camera had a huge role in changing our perception and our ideas about what is art and changing the way we actually saw the world. And today it would be impossible to sort of think about art without the camera. I mean, some of the most popular art forms like film or cinema, TV, right, TikTok, what have you, these are all forms, the very thing we're engaged in right now, these are all art forms mediated by the camera and made possible by the camera. And I imagine that AI has the same capacity to revolutionize the way we tell stories and to revolutionize the way we think about art. What is the AI equivalent of cinema? What is this new form that has yet to be articulated where humans using AI can reach heights that are not possible right now? I mean, we sort of get little glimpses of it here and there if you see how artists experiment with AI, but we're not quite there yet. And I'm hoping that in my lifetime, we'll actually see those new forms evolve in the same way that, you know, those earliest audiences were both terrified but also excited by the first motion pictures, because in those primitive motion pictures, they could glimpse just a very faint echo of the future of Star Wars, of Indiana Jones, of Breaking Bad, of, you know, TikTok trends. They couldn't possibly have foreseen all of that just based on that one little bit clip, in the same way that we cannot foresee where AI art would go just based on the few experiments we can see today. But, you know, the potential is super exciting. So, yeah, that's where I'm.
As a tool, I definitely see I can very clearly see the advantage for a lot of different filmmakers with AI. Specifically, you see some of these different animations that come just from generative AI where you put in prompts and you describe it. I believe Nike recently released an ad that was entirely generative AI, which people are upset about. I understand all that, but just on the final product is incredibly impressive for what we have today. And I can definitely see in the future that there will be young film students and people who have great ideas for a video and like a movie or a TV show or an animation requires a huge team of people. It requires a lot of money. And it seems that AI could be this way to remove that barrier of money and other people, where someone with a vision just with their computer can create it and doesn't need a movie studio to create it. I definitely see that as a potential tool in the future for movies. how would you see AI being used as a tool for writers? Do you have maybe an insight on how that would be used?
Yeah, so I want to actually sort of push a little bit further on what you said there. Mm-hmm. I don't think having AI allow people to make movies is even all that interesting. I mean, I don't. I think even that is
Can I just say, you said my question was uninteresting. I love the gravitas you bring. We need to be, you've both humbled us. We're arrogant because we've had you on the pod, and we're humbled because you've humbled us. Sorry, Ken, continue.
All right. So let me continue. So it's not that the question is not interesting. It's just that I don't think having AI making movies, cool as that may be, is even the height of what I'm trying to do. It's sort of like,
sure, it's what we could see next year. It's not what we could see 10 years, 50
exactly,
years.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm curious about what are the sort of stories that can be told with AI that you can't even understand without AI, if that makes sense. So let me try to sort of push this, right? When they first had motion pictures, they didn't even know what they were going to do, right? The first movies were essentially just filmed versions of stage plays, right? So these things still follow the Aristotelian unities. They had unity of action, of time, of place. But it's only when people were like, wait a minute, we don't actually have to follow that. It's we can invent a whole new grammar of visual storytelling, and people have to learn it, obviously. I mean, it's not like we were born knowing what a reaction shot is. It's not like we were born understanding what a montage is. It's not like we were born and we can interpret, oh, I see, now we're doing the soft lens thing, so this must happen in the past, right? We had to learn all of these conventions. Why is a close-up something that allows you to empathize? Why is, you know, a distant shot giving you that sense of objectivity? Like, all of these cinematic grammar rules were invented, and we had to sort of learn them together on the fly over a period of, you know, several decades. What I'm sort of envisioning is there will be new storytelling techniques using AI, whether it's based on generative responsiveness, whether it's based on the kind of manipulation of images that we will learn to interpret, whether it's based on imitating and drawing forth and making references across the huge repertoire of existing art in a way that's faster and quicker and more more brutal and sort of flashy than what humans can do now. I don't know what that is, right? In the same way that, like, no one could have invented it, but we have to invent a grammar of AI storytelling, AI assisted storytelling that we all have to learn. I mean, I can sort of speculate all kinds of random things, and some of them are more interesting than others. I mean, I can imagine, for example, a TV show or a TV show like thing that is so complicated, that contains so many plots, that contains so many characters, that your average viewer cannot possibly follow them all and cannot even track the story without AI working as a kind of live wiki for them to prompt them and constantly tell them what's going on. That would be interesting and cool. I don't know how I feel about that, but I can see that as being kind of interesting. You might have a story that's kind of like a game, except that, you know, right now it's incredibly tedious as a game writer to, you know, there's somebody who's doing the fun job of writing the overall script, but then tons of people have to go in there and write the stupid dialogue trees. One of the most tedious things imaginable. But imagine we don't have to do any of that. Imagine that human game makers can now script NPCs to do largely, to give them basically a script and allow them to generate their own dialogue as you interact with them. And I mean, I can imagine this giving a qualitatively different kind of feel as you play through, because every single player, they'll have a different playthrough, and they won't even hear the same NPC dialogue. It will be all different. And what does that mean? I mean, is that even interesting?
You can pull that even to the future of maybe different types of television or movies, where movies are not, and where games are interactive. You could have movies in the sense of they're interactive, of responding to an audience of how they're perceiving that the story will change.
Right.
That, I mean, that I could definitely see is something, especially with things like Apple Vision and being like VR headsets, allows for that immersive set where the cameras in that watch your eyes and your face are so good that I can imagine that kind of input could be really helpful in oh, they're responding right. this way to this character. Let's flip it. Or, hey, this person's really liking this character. And that what it would be an interesting emotional reaction to get this character now change them. Now they're hostile.
That's right.
And so now we That's have right. a different emotional reaction.
And right now, right, that kind of thing is largely in gaming, where we have entire genres of like roguelites, where you know, it's the fact that you keep on quote unquote doing the same thing, but each time it's procedurally generated and different. That's where the appeal is. I can imagine stories being done in the same way, procedurally generated stories that have a human, a master storyteller who controls the overall shape, but each iteration or each engagement is completely different. I mean, again, you know, these words sound so abstract. It's because we just don't have the capacity to even imagine it until it happens. But I am so excited about that being true, rather than just having AI do what we already do. I think the thing for me has always been, if what the AI is doing is just allow us to do the things we already do faster, not interesting. But if the AI, or cheaper, not interesting. But if AI's capacity is to allow us to do things we can't do right now at all, that gets me super excited. So that's why, you know, I'm super excited about the sort of things that are not there yet. But as far as AI replacing screenwriters, my answer basically is I don't care. I don't think it's going to happen. And if it happened, humans will do things that are much more interesting.
Do you care about the conversation? So what AI will do in the future, we could speculate. Do you care about the conversation of the morality behind what AI will do and the new things it will create? For example, you touched on that InstaWiki knowledge of, I could see one of my fears of the future. Now, this is very morally gray, but having our cell phones could be a good jumping off point, but everybody has a cell phone now. Will there be an inevitable future where we all have some sort of brain enhancer that if you live without that, you are lesser than the other humans, essentially getting the more sci-fi topics. But what do you think about AI getting into the more morally gray sphere as much as will help? Is there a sort of law of diminishing return to where then it starts to, well, you start to,
you get a sense of people using phones now of you don't need to remember things the same way you used to of their on a basic level, historical dates seem to have been not as focused on, you don't need to memorize dates anymore or interest like facts because you can look it up. If you don't know a specific historical date, you look it up and it's easy. It's the same thing with, I mean, even my generation with, I think a lot of people go through
our generation.
But you start off with grade school, things like you're not allowed to have a calculator because you're forcing you to actually use your brain to learn how to do math with pen and paper and in your mind. And then later on, you got the tool, you're fine. But imagine you start off with only using the calculator and you don't know the fundamental reason on how that actually works. And you start having a group of people that are able to use the tool and don't understand it. And now without the tool, you're kind of lost. And there is something, if you don't use it, you lose it. And that's kind of my fear of even just cell phones today, let alone AI.
Yeah, Ken, do you have any more moral thoughts on that and what AI can AI make us dumber of how things work using the tool, but forgetting how you get the actual knowledge you need to create that tool and also what that line is for AI?
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. These are deep fears, and what I would say is they're not new. I mean, they've been with us since forever, right? I mean, you can sort of go back to thousands of years ago, and you would have philosophers, Plato actually being a very famous example, who ranted and railed against technology, right? He was saying that, look, you know, young people today have this idea that because of this new technology, they can just learn without going to an academy and working with a master teacher. So they think that they can use the technology and they'll just learn what they need to know. And they don't need to memorize things. They don't need to learn to debate. They don't need to learn to really do critical thinking. And this technology is, you know, gives them the illusion that they know something when they in fact don't. They only think they know something, but what they know is superficial. It's not real. They don't have the real knowledge. They merely know where to look up that knowledge, and they think that's the same thing, but it's not. The technology, I mean, you know, what's funny is almost all of his arguments against technology, if you map them out, are structurally identical to the ones we have against ChatGPT or cell phones or calculators. And the technology he was railing against, of course, was writing. I mean, you know, yeah. Austin, to your point, this was very much a fear, right? People who know writing obviously have a huge advantage over people who don't. And access to writing and reading was very uneven. You had to to be well read required a huge amount of resources, and only very few people in the past could do so. And today, of course, you know, everybody has those resources and access to such material, but few of us take advantage of it. Most of us would prefer to just look at TikTok. So the problem is different, but the results are the same. But anyway, to go back to your point. I think this idea of the cyborgization of humanity has been there since forever. I think since the time we invented language, this process has sort of kept on going, right? If you think about it, the moment we invented language, our brains are no longer self-contained, and knowledge is no longer merely within our brains. I mean, this has been true for thousands of years. For thousands of years, humans did not actually contain in their own brains everything they know. They know where to look up certain things. They know where to confirm certain things. They know what tools to use to help them, whether these tools are slide rules or tables of logarithms or calculators or computers in the sense of humans doing the computing. The Manhattan Project relied on computers, except those computers are women sitting in the room doing calculations. So it's not like those dudes who did all the work actually did all the calculations or knew exactly what was going on. They relied on computers in the same way that we today have to rely on the expertise and knowledge of tons of things. I mean, this device is a second brain for me. There's a huge amount of stuff that I claim to know, which I do not know other than the fact that it exists on that thing and I have to go look it up. But I don't think this is necessarily a bad thing. The fact that more and more and more of our brains and our knowledge and our self-awareness and our cognition occurs on hardware platforms outside of our brain is not a bad thing, because that has been like that since forever. The fear that we're going to completely lose control of what we know and the idea that we won't know anything, we'll all just be idiots who know how to push a button, I think it's overblown. I mean, it's overblown in two ways, I guess. One is that it has always been the case for the vast majority of human history that most people merely know what they need to know to use the technology. They do not, in fact, understand how to create the technology. If you take an average person from today and you throw them back into the 16th century, they're not going to become rich because they won't know how to recreate any of the modern stuff. I mean, we run thought experiments like this all the time. The amount of chemistry, physics, mathematics, and practical engineering and just hands-on expertise that you need to create even the most basic of modern conveniences is unimaginable. No average person, much less an expert in the field, can do such a thing. They just don't have all the knowledge to be able to do it. I mean, you think it's easy to, we, you know, prototypically love to tell these time travel stories about how one of us would go back in the past and just become master of the world because we know so much. It's all nonsense. We don't know anything, not in a practical sense. But I think like the most practical thing one of us could invent if we went back would be something like a bicycle. But even that is very, very difficult to be able to actually have the engineering knowledge to build such a thing. Very, very difficult. Again, I don't think 1 out of 100 people in the modern world would be capable of it. Maybe 1 out of 1,000 or even less, fewer. So society has functioned largely based on the fact that we are experts in one or two fields, and we are ignorant of everything else. And it's our combination, our pooling of our knowledge that allows the modern world to keep on going. Even, you know, some expert at designing computer chips, if you told them that they had to go create a chip from scratch using, again, 15th century technology, they can't do it. Just can't. There's so much that they have to know that they don't know. Anyway, back to what we're talking about here. So if more of us now have to sort of do some of our cognition in AI, I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing. I think we will simply end up knowing other things that allow us to use the AI. As long as all of us don't end up treating AI like magic, I'm not terribly worried about it. I mean, you know, all of us rely on the calculator to some extent for doing our calculations. But I think in order to use the calculator effectively, we actually have to understand what the basic underlying functions are. We have to be able to judge whether a result is reasonable. And we have to be able to say, this is a calculation that the calculator can't do. It's going to overrun. So don't trust it. That kind of knowledge, I think we will have to acquire. What are the instances where the AI cannot be trusted? What are the instances where the AI will just give you useless results? What are the places where you can't really use the AI at all? You have to actually go back and do it the old-fashioned way or use some other tools. I think we have to acquire that kind of knowledge, but I'm not terribly concerned about us losing our humanity and expertise because of AI. Now, to go back to some of the other ethics and moral issues, I am incredibly interested in some of these questions, but I don't think they are the questions that are ultimately going to be the ones that will change, you know, the universe. So I'll give you an example. So there's a huge amount of concern over training and the authors of the material being used to train these models, not actually giving permission for that to happen. Yeah. I think that is an incredibly important issue to resolve, but it cannot be resolved legislatively. It cannot be resolved technologically. It has to be resolved legislatively. This is one of those things where we have to rely on the technology of the legal system to solve it. It's not a problem that can be solved by the technologists. They just can't. It's outside of their domain. Who has rights to do what is not a thing that technology can answer for us. And we have to solve that independently. But I'm very optimistic that we can solve those problems. I don't think those are the problems that are unsolvable. And also, I want to be very clear here that I don't think copyright is the right answer at all. I think there's a huge amount of obsession that we have over copyright and whether copyright can provide the answers. And my instinct is no, because copyright is a very blunt instrument. And most of the time, it doesn't even solve the problem we want to solve anyway. To give you a very simple example, if you think copyright is the only issue, then presumably copyright holders are the only people who need to give permission for material to be used for training on these generative AI stuff. But that's not, to me, the right answer at all, because copyright is often held by large corporations, and the individual creators would not be compensated or have any control over what happens to their labor. I mean, American copy law has evolved to basically ignore the concept of moral rights. So because, you know, we view copyright as a purely economic thing. So say the New York Times decides to make its archive of articles available for training, none of the actual reporters and freelance writers who wrote those things would be compensated or have any say over what happens to their words at all. I don't think intuitively we think that's the right answer, or maybe some people do, but I don't. I feel very strongly that individual creators, being the individual inventors of their languages, must have some say in what happens to their words. It's not merely a matter of copyright. So that's why I think these things have to be solved legislatively and outside of, you know, even the current system of rules and rights, because it's beyond that. However, I don't think those are ultimately the most interesting questions, because ultimately, if all that AI does is regurgitate and recombine and imitate what has already been done, it's not a transformative technology. I don't think it has the potential to revolutionize the world much, if that's all it can do. It must at some point be capable of originality in the sense that we understand the term. And at some point, the idea of learning and being trained on existing material just can't be an unresolved problem. And then we have to sort of go to the part where it's about, is the generated material itself actually good enough for more material to be, for more AI to be trained on? I mean, right now the answer is no, right? Right now AI companies don't want their models to be trained on machine output because they know it's garbage. They know it's no good. But at some point, that should no longer be the case. That's where I think the interesting stuff will happen. That's when we sort of talk about what does it actually mean to have originality? What does it actually mean to have machines doing learning? What does it mean to actually co-write with AI or to even trust the output of AI? My feeling is the things that we are incredibly obsessed with right now are important, but they are temporary. They're temporary problems. The really interesting problems will have to come later after we've solved these.
Well, this brings up a interesting question when we're talking about originality. On a basic level, if you think about human originality of, I think, humans and AI.
Save big on all your back-to-school needs, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound packages of flavorful 80% lean ground beef for $3.99 a pound with your card. Then get Oreo cookies, Chips Ahoy, or Kool-Aid jammers for $1.99 each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
In many ways, it's similarly trained of how a writer is. When a writer is training to become a writer, they are reading other people's works. And especially in the beginning, they are just picking up ideas from others and then combining it. Ultimately, an original idea is taking two things and putting them together in a way that hasn't been done before. That's not, I don't see that as being beyond the pale of what AI could do. That seems like a very basic idea. And it kind of goes back to when AI is training on works. And it's definitely different from humans, but in the same way that a author takes two books they read and go, oh, what if we combine these two ideas together? Those authors don't get compensated for that, mm-hmm. for that idea, even though that author was trained on the previous works. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I understand AI is different, but I want to just posit the question on the idea of originality and how humans and AI are being treated differently in many ways, yeah. but they operate the same.
You're again, absolutely right. I mean, you know, there's an argument to be made that there should be no permission required for AI to learn from material that we put out at all. I mean, nobody requires permission from the author to read their books and learn. So why should AI be treated any differently? I mean, like you say, AI is different, at least as currently constituted. So we do have these arguments, but it doesn't have to be that way. Originality also, complicated question. I mean, here's my answer, and I'm not sure it's going to be satisfying to everybody, but it's my answer. My answer is, for me, the fundamental difference really is there a consciousness, a separate consciousness trying to engage with the world in some way? I don't believe originality is merely a matter of recombining existing elements in novel combinations. I really don't. I think that there is something being added, a little spark being added by consciousness in terms of making connections that couldn't exist before, in terms of making a choice, not a random recombination, but a choice-based recombination of existing elements. There's a little spark there that happens that causes something to be called original. And that's not happening with AI right now. Now, people who are big AI proponents will say, well, you're moving the goalpost. You know, like, you know, every time you say this, you're just saying, well, what we do is not what humans do, and therefore it's not good enough. Well, I say, so what? Of course we're moving the goalposts, because we don't really know what intelligence is or consciousness is, which is why we have to sort of figure it out as it happens. I mean, there used to be this idea that if a machine can hold a conversation with you, that means the machine must be intelligent and conscious in some sense, because how can a conversation happened without that. Well, the thing is, we now can do that. And we also know that the model has no consciousness. I mean, I know a few people disagree and they think ChatGPT is conscious, but I don't. I mean, from what I understand of how it works, it's not. So yes, we're going to move the goalpost. The Turing test turned out to be a really bad test and not useful. So we're going to throw it out. But that's entirely normal. If you don't move the goalpost and you're just sort of stuck with what you had before when you didn't understand things, then we're stuck. I mean, I don't see how that's any better. We are going to have to keep on moving the goalpost, and we don't know. We can't define some of the things we're looking for. But so what? Lots of things that are not definable are valuable. And we're going to keep on trying to figure this out. I don't think AI is conscious now, and therefore I don't think it can be original in the way humans are. That's my position. And if somehow that's proven wrong, then we'll just have new goalposts to look for. And I don't really see that as a problem.
The thing I tend to really agree with you on throughout a lot of your answers is the optimism with AI. I think there is sometimes an over fear mongering when it comes to something new. I tend to agree that it's going to be more optimistic than not, whether that comes to a new technology. The example I love to use is with chess and how computers beating humans only improved how humans play chess, even though you could play a more perfect game with AI. AI developed and helped humans become better at the game. And that can happen with writing. That can happen with everything we're talking about. So I tend to be an optimist when it comes to most things. And I'm very curious on your thoughts on this, where it comes to, we can help the audience for some that might not know, the Fermi's paradox, where humans are getting to more into aliens and kind of transitioning this conversation and going, is there a point where species reach a level that we shouldn't because we hit a certain line where all species cease to exist? And this AI conversation, I think, as much as it is going to help, we don't know. Again, we're speculating that it's a theory. We're speculating that, is there a line where species cease to exist because we go too far? We create a Dyson sphere and all of a sudden that sphere, whatever may happen. But Ken, do you have, because with your optimism behind this, is there any ounce of pessimism you have, or do you have any thoughts on where the line is? Do you have thoughts on the paradox itself and that?
Wonderful question. Amazing. So let me tackle this by seeming to go in a different direction, but I promise it's all related. So I'm going to go in a different
just
direction.
Just like an author.
Yes. So recently I've been doing a lot of looking into the history of human speculation about extraterrestrial life, right? It turns out that this is not something that only modern sci-fi authors do. We've been doing this since, again, forever. But what is interesting to me is the degree to which our imaginations are constrained by our assumptions and our ideologies of the time. Okay, so let me try to illustrate this with a few examples. So there was a huge burst of speculation about extraterrestrial life, basically right after the Copernican Revolution, which was almost simultaneous with the European discovery of the New World. Those two events combined to engender a huge amount of speculation about life on other planets. And I'll explain to you why. It's really interesting. It happened because in traditional Christian ideology, which basically was based on a Ptolemaic view of the universe, right? The Earth is the center of the universe and it's special, right? So as Milton put it in Paradise Lost, right? The way you view it is, here's Earth, right? And you have the sun and you have the moon, which are both revolving around it. So they represent the male and the female principle. So God ordered the universe basically to center around the Earth. The Earth was unique. The Earth was literally the center around which all other celestial bodies orbited. And therefore, it makes sense that Earth would be the only place in creation where humanity and animals and plants and all of that stuff exists, because God made us so. We are, in fact, special. We are the center of the universe. Now, the Copernican Revolution threw that wide open, right? One of the things that happened was Galileo, discover the Jovian moons, right? So almost right away, I think Bruno was the one who got super excited and wrote to Galileo and was like, oh my God, do you understand what you've done? You have just proven that there may be life on other planets because we have a moon revolving around us. Now you've proven that Jupiter also has moons revolving around it. That means Jupiter is also a center of a universe. And therefore, why can't Jupiter have life just as Earth does? We are no longer special, right? So this is where the earliest version of the Fermi's paradox came in. This is called the principle of divine plenitude, also known as the principle of mediocrity, which is if there are so many planets, all with moons orbiting around them, Earth is merely one of many and not all that special. Why don't we see life everywhere, right? Surely God would not have created such a huge universe with so many suns and so many planets and so many moons only to have Earth be the place with life. That makes no sense. So right away, you see huge amount of speculation around life on other planets. An English bishop, Wilkins, wrote a whole book about people on the moon. Christian Huygens, the discoverer of Saturn's rings and the inventor of one of the first accurate clocks, wrote this huge book speculating about what life on Jupiter and Saturn would be like. And also, you know, this is obviously also partially pushed by the discovery of America, because again, America has different animals, different plants. And so if we don't even know about life on our own planet, you know, surely there must be life on other planets. So what's interesting to me is, right, all of these speculators were also sort of obsessed with a question that to us would seem ridiculous. They were obsessed with the question of if there are Jovians and Selenites and people on Saturn, Mars, whatever, are they saved and redeemed by the sacrifice of Christ? That is, are these other creatures the seed of Adam or not? This is an incredibly important question. This is the question that got Galileo, you know, punished, because, you know, this is a core issue that everybody had to solve. I mean, to us, it seems like nonsense. We shouldn't be asking this question. But here's the thing, right? The reason they were asking this question was because the same ideology allowed them to think about life on other planets in the first place. It is precisely because the idea that God would not place a bunch of other heavenly bodies around a certain planet without putting life on there that allow people to think there may be life on Jupiter and Saturn. But it's that same ideology that constrained their imagination, that forced them to ask the question, are these creatures therefore the seed of Adam? Right? You see, that's really interesting. The very thing that allowed them to ask the question is also the thing that trapped them in terms of their imagination. If you read Huygens, it's particularly interesting because he reasoned himself into a corner. He was like, well, on these other planets, you have on Jupiter and Saturn, they must have creatures with reason who can think and who conduct astronomy and who think about physics. So they must have hands, because I can't do any of these things without hands. Mm. So they must also have hands. What other ways can they do that? I mean, the notion that you would have intelligence out of this stuff without hands was just preposterous to them. They can't even imagine it. But again, it's because they were trapped in this model, right? He also said, okay, what about war? What about hatred? What about prejudice? Do those aliens have those things? And his answer is, yes, they must do, because again, reasoning from first principles, God is perfect, and yet God put those things into us. Why? Because God wanted us to compete with our enemies, and in that process, design ever better weapons and invent more engineering and discover more science. So that must be true of the aliens too. So even our flaws must be part of the divine plan to make us perfect in the long run. Again, the very ideology that allowed us to ask the question became the trap for how his imagination would run. So now I'm going to run the full circle. This pattern happens over and over again. It's not just with that era. It happened later on when we were talking about canals on Mars. it happens to be the same time when we were thinking about geoengineering the Earth and building canals that would be globe spanning. It sort of is the same as when science fiction writers started thinking about War of the Worlds. It's when there was a huge amount of concern within Europe about invasion of the homeland from the oppressed colonies. Later on, during the 40s and 50s, the golden age of American sci-fi, there was a huge amount of imagination of aliens as hordes, as faceless hordes coming to invade humanity. It's obviously an echo of the Cold War and World War II. So what's interesting to me over and over again is the degree to which the very ideology and the very assumption that allow us to speculate and imagine other possibilities also end up trapping the imagination in certain ways. We can't even see those traps in the moment that they happen, because the very way we're asking the question is framed by that ideology. So, you know, as a Taoist, right, the way I think about it is, this is like that old Taoist principle about water, which is you can only hold up a bowl of water by putting the water inside the bowl, right? The bowl is the container that supports and frames and shapes the water. You can't even hold the water up without it. The bowl is absolutely required. But the bowl is also a prison. It traps the water into that shape, right? So the very thing that supports you and enables you to take shape is also the thing that traps you in that shape. And it's very, very hard when you are holding the bowl to see it simultaneously as an enabling tool, but also a trap. But that's what you have to do. And so my question is, when we're speculating about aliens today, we have the Fermi paradox and all these questions. What are the assumptions and frameworks that are trapping us that we don't even see? They're the same ones that allow us to ask these questions, but just the shape that they take also imprisons us and makes us unable to sort of see in new directions. Now, I don't know exactly what, you know, those things are, because the nature of paradigm shifts is that until they happen, we can't even see it. But I've got to think that the reason why the Fermi paradox appears to be a paradox to us is because we are trapped by our assumptions. We don't know what, I don't even know what the assumptions are that are trapping us, because it's invisible, right? It's the container that allows me to even think. But there has to be a trap here that I'm not seeing that's imprisoning us. So anyway, that's a very long-winded answer and very roundabout, but that's kind of how I think about it. The reason why I'm fascinated by the Fermi paradox is because I see it as a trap. I see it as evidence that our imagination has been constrained in some way that I can't figure out.
That's fascinating, because you summed it up great at the end there to make that comprehensible, where is this also what you're saying, is that with the Fermi's paradox, although you don't have the answer, you think there is an answer that will be found, maybe not in our generation, but in some future space, there will be some solution to why are we not seeing aliens, and why there will be an answer that is not yet posited. And
eventually the bowl will break and we will have a different bowl.
And we will be incredibly amazed. We'll be like, how could we not have seen it? Right. Why weren't we even asking that question? Well, reason we weren't is because we're trapped in our time. I often say that, you know, we make fun of our predecessors. Like, I don't mean to make fun of the early speculators for being concerned about this question of, are Martians the seed of Adam? It seems funny to us, but that's not because we're wiser. It's just we're later in time. That doesn't make us any wiser. We just happen to have a lot more stuff to look at, and we happen to have allowed everyone before us to make mistakes. It doesn't make us any wiser, and we're going to have to do the same thing. I mean, today we're confused. We don't know why the Fermi paradox is the way it is. We can't understand why no one has answered us. But, you know, maybe 100 years from now, people will be like, oh my God, they were asking the wrong questions.
Like one day when the AI overlords look back at, Ken supported us. We will allow him to continue on, and his bloodline shall continue. So I wanted to touch on one thing, not to throw us too off, but I'm so curious because we're very open on this channel. We're agnostic, but curious about religion. And I don't know too much about Taoism. And I'd just be curious to go, like, could you help us understand a little bit about, I know we can't go into a whole lecture about this, but I know this is a big question, but what is Taoism from my very little understanding?
Yeah, it's a great question, actually, because there's actually a lot of debate over what Taoism is. So I think one of the interesting things that I've learned is that when we speak about a religion, we don't actually even mean the same thing, right? If you look at, you know, there are people, scholars, really, who have debated for years, is something like Buddhism a religion in the way that Christianity is a religion? Because for us in the West, right, the Judeo-Christianity and Islam are sort of the models for religion. So things that look like Judaism, Christianity, and Islam in some way, we say these are religions. But Buddhism doesn't really look like that at all. It's very, very different in terms of what is a belief. I mean, the fact that many Buddhists in many parts of the world say they have no problem believing Christianity and Buddhism at the same time drives people nuts. You know, people who are very embedded in this Western model of what a religion is find that ridiculous. How can that possibly be true? But it is true. And Buddhism is closer to a religion than something like Taoism is. Taoism is even more not like a religion. And so a lot of people say maybe it's just a philosophy. Well, it's a little more than that. So it's hard. It's hard to pin it down. Mm-hmm. So in terms of what I want to say is, I would say I think of Taoism largely as a philosophy, but it's not necessarily a philosophy in the same sense that, you know, Plato and Aristotle are philosophers.
Stoicism isn't to Taoism? Those, would you put those on the same...
I would put them in similar categories. Okay. Yes. Got it. They are very close to each other. Yes, absolutely. And so Taoism is, you know, I would say a philosophy, but it also has mystical elements to it. But if you sort of pare away some of that and sort of boil it down to its very basic, it's this belief that I would say that Taoism has a very mystical bend to it. And it basically believes that there is an order to the way the universe operates, and that it is better for us to harmonize with that order rather than to strive against it. And the order of the universe is not something that is without conflict or opposition. You know, Taoism speaks yin and yang and the binariness of it. But it very much emphasized the idea that both sides, the yin and the yang, are in fact aspects of the same unity, that the pattern and the nature of the universe is such that all of these binary oppositions are to be resolved ultimately in a oneness that we don't necessarily see right away, but it is there, and that we are happier and more satisfied when we harmonize ourselves to that order rather than trying to strive against it. So a lot of Taoism is about paradoxes. The marriage of Buddhism and Taoism is Zen Buddhism, which I think a lot of Westerners are much more familiar with. The dedication to paradoxes, to asking questions that seem to have no answers, that's very much, an aspect of the mystical aspect of Taoism, this idea of let's not trust language, let's not trust our perceptions, because these things are misleading. The real nature of the universe requires deeper understanding of where the binaries merge into a unity. And I think that's why also Taoism is very attractive to a lot of us who are now trained in the modern scientific framework, because the more you understand the science of things, the more you realize how reality is very, very different from our macro scale model of it, right? I mean, light is both a particle and a wave. Atoms are, in fact, mostly quote unquote emptiness, whatever that means. I mean, these are very weird things to think about. And Taoism would say, well, that weirdness is inherent in the nature of the universe. It's the yin and the yang. And the fact that you are puzzled is because you have not truly understood the nature of the universe, and you need to go with it. So that's kind of my short summary of it.
which goes very hand in hand with your thought on the Fermi's paradox of that example you gave with the bowl and water in and not spilling over. Rich and I know what we really appreciate about, we've read The Grace of Kings, and we've done the sacrilege of not reading on yet because there's so many books to read. And we will. We are our patrons. And shout out Orcish Dad, who is one of our OG patrons. Didn't say I would say OG in front of Ken Liu, but you know what? He's one of our original patrons, and he is, and others are pitching The Wallstorms, like, gotta read it now. And something I know Rich and I appreciate about your books is that we like getting the more Eastern philosophy as well, and because we can get used to a lot of fantasy can have kind of the same basis. And so when Rich, you read like The Rage of Dragons, having and also The Grace of Kings, we love our Sword of Kai again, the kind of getting a different.
I love Lord of the Rings. I love it. I love our Western fantasy stuff.
I love Lord of the Rings great, too.
But sometimes I want something a little different, from a different culture that is not what I'm always used to. So that's why I'm always shocked of looking at more African-based fantasy. I don't know why there's not more. Like Rage of Dragons is the only one that I actually know of, and looking around, I don't know. I don't see a lot. And
There's a bunch. I mean, I would definitely look into, Nnedi Okorafor. I would definitely look at what Tochi Anyabuchi is writing. These are all great African-inspired fantasists. We live in a really great age. I mean, I feel like if you were talking about 20 years ago, I think it is much harder to find good examples. But today, with Afrofuturism and Afro fantasy, it's just, there's so much great stuff coming out of being Africa-inspired fantasy. It's really a wonderful time.
Yeah, we have, I got that. I think I have the names down for you. I gotcha.
But one of the best parts of The Grace of Kings for me is, like, of course, the standard stuff of like the characters, plot, all that. What I loved was the perspective on a interest, like something you don't often see, of the time scale and how the story is told, the uniqueness of how the gods are in play but not really. There's a weird perspective of it that you don't see in many other books, and that is the thing I enjoyed most about the book.
And please tell us to shut up at some point, because I don't want to lead us into another taking so much of your time. Because with that different perspective with The Grace of Kings, I know that something we've seen, and we're shocked that you could see that some other booktubers like us out there love The Grace of Kings. It is their thing. And you look at the Paper Menagerie, which gets all these awards, super critically acclaimed, very high ratings. The Grace of Kings, initially, a Goodreads rating, not that that is the per... That is not the bastion of what ought to be good art. But the Goodreads rating being lower on The Grace of Kings is surprising, because you wrote a book, and not to muddy this with, you had an interview on with Bookborn. You had a collaboration there, and you went into what you thought about awards and how when you write something, and I'm using, these are your words, and I hope I don't butcher them too much, but you were saying how when you're going for an audience, you can kind of go for something that is either 80% or 100%, satisfies 100% of people. And sometimes it's good to satisfy 80% of people, and they miss that 20% just because if you're going to satisfy 100% of people, the 100% person out there is more of a niched audience. That exact book that you're going to find, the more popular viral books that are just everybody loves, satisfy 80% of everybody's itch because it has something for everybody. But that last, if I'm not butchering your words too poorly, but with The Grace of Kings and your books, do you lean more into that? You know what? I am focused more on a particular reader. I'm reaching out to this person out there. I'm not trying to appease the masses.
I know exactly what you're talking about, and you're right. So let me try to explain what I do in a way that I think matches what I really am trying to say better. So as an artist, right, when you're writing, you're always trying to balance between, this is the stuff that appears to work really well in the market, and this is the stuff I want to do. should I triangulate between them and achieve something that sort of does both? Can I do the thing that I want to do, but also satisfy and tick all the boxes that I think the reader is looking for? And I think that's a good model for what's happening. I think that's a good model. But I don't actually think it's all that accurate in terms of what I'm doing. So let me explain to you why.
Okay? Yeah, absolutely.
The reason why I don't think that model is particularly good for me is because as I've gotten more experience in the field, I'm more and more doubtful about how good writers are really at intuiting and figuring out the things that tick all those boxes for readers. Okay. So I know there are writers who are like, I know how to write a bestseller. I know it. Here's a formula. Here's XYZ you got to do. And if you do these things, you have a bestseller. I know they're really confident about what they're saying. And I actually know some writers who have told me repeatedly that they can execute a bestseller, no problem. And they just need a bit of luck to get that happen. I'm not disbelieving them, but I will say that I myself don't seem to have that skill. The longer I've been writing, the more I find this art that I practice mysterious. The more I find the connection between reader and book to be something that I don't know how to explain. Okay. Mm. And I think that's actually a good thing. It actually has restored my faith in art, because I'll tell you why. If it is true that there are specific qualities you can point to that allow certain books to be successful, if there are certain specific things you can point to about a script and say, this is why this movie will be a hit, then you've essentially turned art into an optimization problem. And you know who's really good at optimization problems? Computers. If I'm believing that vision of art, then I really should not be in this business anymore, because ChatGPT 35 or ChatGPT 38 will optimize the hell out of these problems and write the perfect fantasy book that will click everyone's boxes. And it will generate the perfect script. It's going to hit all the four quadrants and everybody is going to love it and it's going to win all the awards. I fundamentally don't believe that. I just fundamentally don't believe that vision. I don't think that's how art works. I think what happens is writers try their best to write the book that they want to read themselves and try to execute that vision. And sometimes they're lucky and they do something that touches the zeitgeist, the collective unconscious, in such a way that everyone's like, holy moly, this is the perfect book. And sometimes it doesn't happen. Okay. And they do the best thing they can, and only maybe 20% of the readers resonate with it. And I don't think they can control that ahead of time. I'm not sure that they really can. I think writers who say, I'm just going to write the book that I want to write and I don't really care who reads it or not. And I think Cormac McCarthy is somebody who's like that. And, you know, his books are popular for literary novels. They're incredibly popular. And I don't think he went out to write popular books. I think he went out to write books that he wanted to read. And I think that's what a lot of us do. A lot of us say that we're trying to write popular books, but I'm not sure we know how. I think we try to write the best books that we can, the books that we really love. And sometimes we're lucky, and a lot of people fell in love with those books too. But I'm not entirely convinced that it's something that we can engineer and control all that well. So that's kind of how I view it.
Gotcha.
I'm not convinced that that it is possible to deliberately set out to write a bestseller. I think if that were true, we would have a lot more people being successful at this business than we do. I think it's so much more based on luck than anything else.
You're trying to write the book that you want to be a bestseller. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, not that there's an actual objective there, but what you at least think, hope, believe would be.
Because you think you're tapping to something universal. Because you think you're tapping to something about the human condition that is cool. I mean, you know, I think writers ultimately are like kids, right? I mean, if you remember when we were kids, you go out and play and you see something, you see the shiny rock, and you're like, holy moly, this is the most beautiful thing ever. You bring it back and show all your friends and show your family because you think it's cool. You think this is actually something wonderful, amazing, universal. I think that's what writers are. If we grab a story, a lot of us think the story is so moving to me because it's universal. It's wonderful. It's beautiful. I want to share it. And, you know, if we're lucky, a lot of other people agree. And if we're not, some people will still agree. And that's wonderful, too.
To finish us off with this question from our patron, Esty, we always like to finish with, you know, buttering up the people that pay us. Got to, you know, sorry, Ken. He has this great question. So think puts a capsule on a lot of your thoughts. And he asks, many of your stories explore themes of technology, identity, and the human experience. What draws you to these particular themes? And to kind of add on to put a capsule on that is what makes you so curious? Because clearly you are a deep thinker and clearly you love these themes as Esty's describing. What brought you to this? How did you create this personality and where'd this come from?
Wow.
Tell us how you came so start, to be start and at, your idea.
Start at age one, where you went to school,
Oh my God. I mean, I wish I have a great answer for this, but I don't. I here's my best attempt at answering, which is, I don't know. I think, okay, so I have a theory. I have a theory that all of us, you know, are born into this world and we're just trying to, I mean, if you think about it, we are pretty amazing creatures, right? There's no one like us in the billions of years before us. And I would imagine there's not going to be another person like us in the billions of years that comes after us until the universe ends. So between that eternity, there's this tiny, tiny, tiny little flash in which you're conscious. That is incredibly miraculous that you got the chance to do this. You got the experience to experience the universe for that little brief flash. So what is the meaning of that, right? I mean, surely you were created and you're going to die, but in that little brief flash, what are you meant to do? So my own mystical theory is that you're supposed to craft a story. A story about who you are, a story that you tell yourself about who you are. And if you're lucky, by the time you die, you're like, I told the story I wanted to tell. This is actually the story I want to tell. And now I can fade into the eternal darkness, having told my story. And that was my purpose. I did it. I think that's what we're all trying to do, right? So what is my story? I feel like the thing that has characterized my own creative pursuit as an artist throughout has been this deep interest in what does it mean to be human, right? And my answer is a little bit different from a lot of answers I've heard before, which is I think there's a deep tradition of viewing humanity as something separate from, say, technology, from politics, from all the other stuff that we add into our lives. They're viewed as complications. And to be human means you sort of reject those things and search for the purity of the human experience. I don't think that's quite right, at least not for me. I sort of view being human as inseparable from our craft, right? Humans are distinguished by the fact that we make a lot of stuff. We have this capacity of imagining things that don't exist and then actually make them exist. If you think about it, that is pretty wild and incredible, right? Like before there were humans, there were no such things as airplanes. And humans imagined flying with the machine and then actually building a machine to make that true. Before humans, there were no such thing as spaceships that could go to the moon. Again, humans imagined such a thing, and we actually made it true, and we went to the moon. I mean, that is not like anything else. That is wild. Right. We humans can imagine things that don't exist and then make them exist. If that's not magic, what is? We are magical creatures. We are a species capable of bringing into being things that have never existed in the history of the universe just by act of will, by imagination. It's wild. And so to me, our capacity for making things, our technology, is inseparable from who we are. In the same way that you can't possibly study bees without studying beehives, and you can't possibly study beavers without studying their dams. How can you understand human nature without understanding human craft and human imagination? Our capacity to bring the world of possible things that don't exist and turn them into reality. That is who we are. This is the essence of our species. And I'm deeply fascinated by that. So, you know, the themes of technology, of identity, of what does it mean to be human? What does it mean to do this thing of existing in against entropy for this brief second, just so we can get a chance to make something that didn't exist before. I think that's what we're meant to do. All of us are put into this universe for the purpose of acting as this summoning force into the great void of potential things that could exist but don't, and make them real. Anyway, that's kind of why I'm obsessed with these themes, and this is how I think about it.
Great answer.
That's a cooler name to name humans. Instead of being called humans, we're dream crafters.
Yes, realizers.
That's the fantasy term for humans.
That is great. Ken, thank you so much for coming on. I loved your answers. This was super insightful for us. Rich, can you speak for us too and say this was awesome?
This is a great time. Really enjoyed talking to you and hearing all you have to say. Definitely an interesting perspective on AI that especially before this conversation, did not have, and you've given me a lot to think about.
Ken, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Fred.
And if there's anything you want to leave the audience with of, Grace of Kings, go buy Grace of Kings, go buy Paper Menagerie.
Brand new book you want to pitch out? Anything you particularly want people to go out and buy?
I don't have anything to pitch yet. I mean, I do have actually, I did a new translation of the Tao Te Ching, the Taoist classic that's coming out from Simon Schuster later this year in August. So that's pretty cool. So that's why I'm thinking so much about Taoism. I am working on a new novel, I hope it will come out next year. And that also delves a lot into the stuff about AI, about art, about what it means to be an artist in the age of AI. So I'm excited about that.
Well, hey, if you want some alpha readers, some beta readers, feel free to send it our way.
Hey, do you have a title yet, or what stage is it on?
I don't have I don't have a title yet. I have a working title, but I don't want to say it. So
Okay. Yeah. Well, all right. Ken, thank you so much. We're signing off. We will see everybody next episode. Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone.
How do people feel about getting Big Fitness Energy at Planet Fitness for $15 a month? They feel as thrilled as a kid the first summer they're tall enough to ride the roller coaster. That's right. When you join Planet Fitness right now, you get access to tons of equipment and free fitness training in a clean and spacious club. Don't wait. Join the judgment-free zone today for that all-day energy. Download the free Planet Fitness app and join today for $15 a month.
Hurry. Deal ends September 12th. Join today for $15 a month.
See Home Club for details.